for meetings, and thank you for coming. I know it's been a heavy Zoom day and whatever. So there are the usual etiquette rules that we follow and which have worked really well. Next slide, please. Next. Okay, so we had these two electronic votes on two tenure-related resolutions, and they both passed. I just want to remind you that the tenure policy is not owned by any one group. So it's basically shared between the university faculty and the provost office. So whenever changes are proposed, one has to sort of get approvals all around. Oftentimes HR and university council is involved. On these matters, the tenure pause was actually developed with the provost office and our AFPSF committee. So that one's pretty much a done deal. It's up to the law school how they carry forward their clinical tenure resolution. But I'd like to say something, next slide, I'd like to say something about the turnout, which was not great. Now I know we're all stressed out and extremely busy, but this is shared governance. And when we have the turnout like that, it says something. Okay, now I know everyone, you're busy, you forgot or whatever, but it doesn't look good. And we have to do something about that. And if any of you want to speak up about that right now or send me an email about how we can improve these kinds of things, because again, it doesn't send a positive message. We're very much in favor of shared governance. We make a lot of, we talk about it all the time, and then we can't show up at the table with this. Okay. Next slide, please. So we have, well, later today, we're going to talk about these calendar options for the next academic year. And we announced this to the Senate on Friday. I guess students got wind of it, which is fine, over the weekend. And then on Memorial Day, it went crazy. We have, there are now 600 postings on it. So most of them from undergraduates and parents. So it's actually extremely valuable reading. If you have some time and browse through that, it's very important to see how others think about this situation we're in. The downside, of course, is that the faculty postings got drowned out, but I took some steps to pull some of those out, and there's now a separate place where faculty can post their comments. So we've never had this kind of an overrun on any of our topics. Next slide, please. So right now, the current plan is to have a June 10 meeting. That'll be our last regularly planned meeting. But as we talked about earlier, we should be ready to meet on a need-to-meet basis all through the summer. As you know, the reopening committees, the two of them are going to produce their reports June 15th, and probably within 1 or 2 weeks after that, there'll be some very major decisions. So that might be a time when we stage an impromptu meeting and so on. So let me just pause at this point. Are there any comments about these three items here in the announcements? Okay, next slide. So accreditation, we've all heard about it, and every so often we have to do it. This is Middle States, and we have the two individuals who are leading that effort right now, and it's be good to get a brief overview of what they're up to, why we do accreditation, and what's going to happen. So, Marin, are you on the line?
I am.
Okay, take it away.
Okay, we could go to the title slide, and I'll just take that as an opportunity to introduce myself. I used to work in Day Hall, and now I work from my living room. And I serve as the accreditation liaison officer for the university. So as Charlie introduced, this is not a COVID-related topic. This is very much business as usual that was well underway before the pandemic broke out. And my co-chair is Mike Fontaine, who I think many of you know, and he's on here as well. Slide, please. University accreditation, there's also, you know, program accreditation. A lot of professional programs have accreditation. The medical school has accreditation with the medical agency. Lots of professional programs accreditation, but there's also university level accreditation. and that is a process of peer review. So there's an agency, Middle States Commission on Higher Ed, that coordinates this for us, but it is very much run by colleagues and peers from other universities, and those would be faculty and administrators from other schools that will ultimately come and visit us sometime soon. Slide, please. Accreditation is voluntary, but not voluntary at all. It is a voluntary peer review process that is old and predates the rules that say that accreditation through one of these types of agencies is required in order for us to receive federal dollars. So it is very much not a voluntary activity anymore. Slide. Next slide, please. Covers the breadth of the university, all the professional programs that have their own professional program accreditation, as well as our operations in New York City and around the world. And accreditation is an old thing, goes back to 1921 for us at Cornell. Slide, please. Accreditation is guided by a set of standards. The specific numbers of standards has changed over time, and sort of the thrust of them has changed over time. These particular standards have only been around for 3 years, I think, but it's a different organization of what used to be 14 different standards last time we went through the big stealth study process. So the basic thrust is that, you know, we want to ensure that the university is operating under clearly established mission and goals, that it operates with ethics and integrity. I think of the middle three standards as the meat of what we do. This is, you know, delivering our educational mission to students and assessing that we're doing it well. And then standard six has to do with planning. Budget processes, you know, and how do we plan for institutional improvement, and then finally issues of governance, leadership, and administration. So that covers sort of the president, the provost, the deans. How is that organized and assessed? Shared governance with the Senate and the assemblies, and then the board of trustees. How are those people selected, and so forth? Slide, please. So our last big visit accreditation activity was in spring 2011. At that time, we were on a 10-year cycle. Durba Ghosh has said that our accreditation story over the last decade is sort of, you know, accreditation between two global calamities. So in the 2011 thing, we were writing about the recession of 2009. And the structural deficit and all that we did at that time to sort of respond to the financial crisis. There was a minor set of activities at the five-year mark. It used to be a 10-year cycle, which made it nice for talking about decennial accreditation. They switched to an eight-year cycle without a five-year visit. So the eight-year cycle, next time it's an eight-year cycle, our accreditation is up for renewal in spring 2021, but we opted 2 years ago that we would go for a fall 2020 visit and get this all over with. So that is our timeline. It'll be affirmed in spring 2021. And all of that was established before the pandemic, of course. The most recent activity that transpired is in April 14th and 15th. We were supposed to host our evaluation team chair on campus. That visit happened over Zoom and involved a lot of meetings over Zoom for, if we could have the next slide, the president of Penn State, Eric Barron. So Eric Barron spent a lot of time with us on Zoom over a day and a half, essentially. And he met with a number of people, including folks from the Board of Trustees, including the chair, President Provost, and so forth. He was terrific. He was really quite engaged. Seems like a nice guy, very sane, and very oriented to how to make this process useful for us at Cornell. So he paid careful attention to the draft self-study that we have been working on with a committee structure that I think we talked about maybe a year ago when we were here last. And he provided wonderful feedback. Slide, please. So next steps in the process is that we will have an evaluation team. It's typically organized now with one person on each standard. So we have a president, we'll get six more. Those folks will come from peer universities. First pass of those, I've seen folks from, of who's going to be on our team, Carnegie Mellon, Penn, I can't remember, it's not finalized yet. Anyway, once we know who's going to be on our evaluation team, we'll put it on our website, which I'll show you in a minute. We have a self-study draft. It will be finalized and mailed to the evaluation team by September 1st. And then we have a visit scheduled October 11th through 14th. It was at the time that we scheduled it corresponding to fall break. Who knows what it corresponds to now? Slide, please. So what the heck? We did all this before there was a pandemic. We sort of stamped the draft of our self-study and sent it to the president of Penn State to read the day before the pandemic, before Martha's first email about students not returning from fall break. We have had conversations of the Middle States Commission. We're not the only ones in this place. For example, Middle States has talked very much about how do they respond now that everything's changed at the university. And the thrust of it is, this is not going to be, we're not going to rewrite the self-study to talk about how Cornell has responded to the pandemic. It is still very much a document that is about our enduring qualities and how we operate as a general thing. But we may draft a appendix to describe our response to the pandemic and how that aligns with the standards. But if we do that, it will be a very short thing. Our visit date is staying intact as October 11th through 14th. But it, of course, it's possible that the visit could be a virtual one, and we will share more as we know more. Slide, please. We do have an accreditation website of our own, and Middle States has a website with more information about the standards. Slide, please. If you go to our accreditation website, accreditation.cornell.edu, there are a few tabs across the top, one of which is the self-study. The draft of the self-study, if you push slide, please, is linked there from a little link at the bottom of that thing. So that's like a big old document, about 145 pages long. It's organized by standard. Each standard had a working group. Slide, please. Each working group was chaired by a faculty member, and the steering committee then is the compilation of all those faculty members, the chairs of the working groups, and a handful of others who have experience in accreditation activities, like me, like Alan Matthews, who has served on the Middle States Commission, and so forth. And I think that brings me to the end of our presentation. And I am happy to answer any questions, or Mike Fontaine may have additional comments.
Any raised hands? Jill, anything on the chat line?
Nothing. Nothing. No questions, no raised hands.
Wonderful.
Okay, thanks an awful lot, Marin and Michael as well. So we'll be interested in seeing how this plays out in the coming months. So.
Thank you. Okay.
Very good. On to the next thing. So Bruce Lewinstein is wrapping up his 4-year stint as faculty trustee, and in that position, you think about big pictures and long-term things all the time. And Bruce wanted to say a few things about an effort that he wants to sort of lead in the fall. Bruce.
Great. Thank you, Charlie. And thanks very much for giving me some time, brief time on the agenda. This is really just in the context of an announcement. The next slide, please. As Charlie said, I'm ending my 4-year term. I had my last regular board meeting last weekend. Melissa Hines from chemistry continues for 2 more years in her term, and Abby Cohen from linguistics will be stepping in to a new term beginning July 1st. But as Charlie said, there, one of the things you do on the board is you have to think long-term. We had a, there was something in one of our presentations last week that talked about planning for perpetuity. That led me to be thinking, even before COVID-19, this is another non-COVID issue, that we needed to be thinking about what the university looks like. Next slide, please. There should have been a slide in between. It says goal. Okay. If not, that's okay. The goal, well, we lost a slide. That's okay. The goal of this exercise is for us to think about what would a world-class research, teaching, and public service university look like 20 to 40 years from now. Notice the assumption there that we would still be a world-class research, teaching, and public service university. One of the things we actually have to think about is, can we do all those things in a new world? And then how could we get from here to there? And I don't anticipate we're gonna have answers. This is the beginning of a campus-wide conversation where we would begin with a discussion among faculty. Staff also need to be involved. I think we want student input, but frankly, this isn't for the students. This is for us. And we are the core of the university, and some of the people who are here now, I'm not going to be here 20 to 40 years from now. I got a lot of gray hair here in my beard, but there are people who we have all recently met, who we've brought to campus, who will be here 20 to 40 years from now. And we need to be thinking now about what that university looks like and how we would get there. What are some of the things that have triggered this? The fundamental one is that we currently have a financially unsustainable model. Tuition, we are extraordinarily proud of the fact that 5 years ago, for the first time in something like 40 years, actually the second time, there was one year, but basically for at least 40 years, we had not been able to keep our tuition increases below 40%. Now for the last below 4%. Now for the last 5 years, we have been able to keep them down to 3.9%, but that's during a time when the inflation rate has been below 2%. That's an unsustainable model. We just keep getting more and more expensive. Those of you who depend on research funding know that it's harder and harder, that pay lines are going down, that the competition for funding, we know that things like state funding will be more limited and so on. We also know that a vision that many of us have about the value of education is not necessarily widely shared. And this is irrespective of political position. There are deep concerns about the affordability of education, about the value that is returned, about whether this is an appropriate investment. Obviously, some of those have been exacerbated by the current crisis, but they long predate it. I'm assuming, here's another assumption, that we are committed to high quality in-person faculty-led teaching. That's an important part of our ethos. I think some of the work that we're very proud of the fact that we don't rely on contingent faculty in the same way that many other places do. And yet, as Charlie's work on RTE faculty has shown, up to 40, depending on how you count, it might be over 40% of the people with teaching appointments of various kinds, lecturers, professors of the practice, clinical professors, and so on. That's almost 40%, or more than 40% of our overall teaching faculty. So we need to be honest with ourselves about how we are structuring our institution and who's doing the work. We have to think about changing, and I should also say that at our last meeting, the discussions about the law school clinical professor and about some of the issues at the vet school, where we went in different directions because we needed to solve problems now. But in the end, we have to have a university-wide discussion about what do we actually think tenure means, and how does that, are we content to have different standards across the university? Do we wish to have a universal model? That's a discussion we have to have. They're clearly changing modes of teaching. Again, predating COVID, many of us were moving some of our activities online. The active learning initiative that has started to draw on the kind of research about pedagogy that is bringing evidence to how we think about how people learn and the variety of ways and how that varies across discipline and so on. We need to think about how we're going to integrate those. I've put a question mark after overproduction of PhDs. In some fields, probably not. In other fields, perhaps yes. That involves us asking ourselves honest questions about, just because people want a PhD, is it appropriate for us to accept them into our programs? Are we accepting students just because we need them as TAs, as again, part of our teaching structure? This has obviously implications for things like graduate student unionization and those kinds of issues about how we think about who our graduate students are and what their role is in that overall comprehensive university. We have to think about definitions of scholarship. This again goes back to that tenure discussion. 25 years ago, the former head of the Carnegie Foundation published a work on scholarship reconsidered, where he was talking about different categories of discovery and application and engagement and teaching as a form of scholarship. We need to think explicitly about that. We should be looking at other models of other places that are, let's say, graduate only, whether it's someplace like Rockefeller, which has a graduate school, or the Salk Institute, which does not have its own program, though it's tied to UCSD. We should look at the Olin College of Engineering, which is an engineering only new undergraduate school. We should look at Station One, which is the program created by Christine Ortiz, from MIT, which is trying to reimagine what education looks like. We need to have all of these different models, and we need to have an open discussion about them. So today, what I'm primarily doing is announcing, we need to have this conversation. I hope to convene a faculty forum sometime in the fall. It would be lovely if we could do it in person. It may well be virtual, some kind of webinar thing, but I would be glad to hear from anyone who is concerned about these issues. I've actually already, since it appeared on the agenda, Brian Chabot has sent me information about the history of curriculum changes across the university over time. But I'd be glad to hear about topics we should be considering, readings that you think are really useful, that you think we should have on some kind of comprehensive reading list, speakers, either here on campus or off campus, who you think ought to be part of this conversation. So I'm glad to take any questions now, but as I say, primarily this was to begin a much longer conversation. Thank you.
Mark.
Bruce, I was just kind of wondering, in terms of framing some of the questions, about your comment here, especially your second bullet up there, affordability, value. What is, do you think, the future role that a university is going to play? Is it going to be sort of a university that is more for a job market training, or is it going to be a university for more of the pedagogy of just pure thought? Because my concern is, if we take a look at majors, has the pay scale for some of these majors kept with inflation? If we're charging a lot of tuition and yet their pay is not keeping with that, are we doing a disservice to some of the students who could probably come out with the same major, but let's face it, at another institution which does not have such a steep or high tuition? So I'm wondering if we kind of think about this.
Those are absolutely the questions that I think need to be part of a conversation. And I don't think a particular Senate meeting is the right place. That's why I would like to have a bigger forum. But, one of the geniuses of Cornell is that we have both the public side and the private side. And these represent two of the great traditions in American education, the traditional liberal arts, it's all about learning, and the professional education, it's all about preparing for a particular field with that expertise. I think the thing that makes Cornell such a wonderful place is that we have creative tension between those models. But then that starts running up against a practical world where people are feeling squeezed, where this tuition issue doesn't keep up, where faculty are, I know many of us complain about our pay, but compared to many other fields, we're not poorly paid. And one of the issues is that our salaries go up, but our, quote, productivity does not. This is a standard problem in a number of fields, the creative arts and so on. It's called Baumol's disease. And how do we address that problem? And so I think the kind of issue, Mark, that you raise is precisely the kind of issue that we need to have on the table.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on then. Thanks an awful lot, Bruce, and thank you so much for your 4 years of great service as one of our faculty trustees.
Thank you. You'll be hearing from me again.
Okay. Let's go on to the reopening committee updates and reports. So as you recall, there are three of them. The research and supporting operation committee has already done their report. There's been actions on it. The provost just got done running a one-hour webinar on it. And Chris Schaefer is the Senate's representative in that scene. And Chris, I wonder if you can just give us a brief overview of the report, the high points, things that may be confusing or controversial, whatever. Chris.
Great. Hi, it's Chris Schaefer from the Biomedical Engineering Department. And I'm sure most folks were on the big town hall that Provost Kotlikoff just hosted, announcing the reactivation of campus and answering questions. So I'll try to be very brief. The sort of core tenet of this report and the approach to reactivating research activities on campus is the recognition that faculty and center directors and other scholars are going to know best what kinds of on-campus resources they need, by whom, and on what kinds of timescales or what kinds of schedules in order to get their scholarship done. So the onus, this report really puts the onus on individual faculty members to propose plans to their departments and center directors that need to be evaluated and looked at and commented on at the department level, as well as the college level. And these plans need to articulate several key things. So one, what are the on-campus resources that are needed for the research that's being reactivated? This isn't just an opportunity to come back to campus for things that would be easier to do on campus. It needs to be resources that require use. It needs to be research that requires the use of on-campus resources. So what's the work and why does it require on-campus resources? Who would be the people that would do that work? How has the workspace been laid out and arranged in ways where individuals can remain socially distanced from each other and be able to avoid transmitting the virus? How will use of the workspace be scheduled? How will that scheduling be coordinated among other facilities or research labs that are on the same wing or the same floor or within the same building? So what kinds of disinfection procedures would be used to clean your way into, clean the workspace, and clean your way back out? So the report basically outlines these as the key things that faculty need to address for their workspaces and for their research environments. Some colleges have already moved forward with plans for these applications to be submitted and approved. Other colleges, I think they're forthcoming very soon. Just a couple of quick comments, because I know these are things that were points of tension as we were developing this report, and I thought I would just address them right at the beginning. So the first is, it is true that this initial reactivation is limited to certain classes of STEM-based research. This was not a decision that Cornell is making. This is a decision from the state of New York. So the Cornell University is reactivating all work that we are permitted to by the state of New York. It is anticipated that there'll be, and my understanding is that the higher levels of the administration are actively negotiating for now, but is anticipated there would be a relaxation of what classes of research count for this reactivation. The other thing I'll say, I know there was a lot of concerns about locality to Ithaca being required to be able to get access to on-campus resources. At least until widespread testing and contact tracing and other mitigation strategies are in place. The requirement is that anyone who wants to use on-campus resources needs to have been in the local Ithaca area, which is currently defined as about 50 miles from Ithaca. But you need to have been in the local Ithaca area for the last 2 weeks. And you need to, and no one in your household can have gone out of the local Ithaca area in the last 2 weeks if you're going to come on campus and use on-campus resources. So those were just, I know, a couple of things that had come up while we were putting the report together, and I thought I'd head those off before there's any other questions. But I'd be happy at this point to take any other questions, comments, or suggestions.
Questions for Chris. Okay, well, very good. And thanks an awful lot, Chris, for serving on this committee. I know it's been a pretty intense 2 or 3 weeks there, and it's very nice to see forward motion like this. Even though it has to be slow and very careful, it's a very optimistic development to see us moving in this direction.
It's been my pleasure to serve on the committee.
Thanks, Chris. Okay, let's go on to the other two committees that are still in full operation. One is concerned with looking at a possibly online semester and making it as good as possible. And the other one is, let's look at a semester where there's an on-campus presence and make that as good as possible. And Shorna and Courtney are representatives on those two committees. And I asked them to give us maybe a brief overview of what's been going on in the last few meetings and weeks. I know last week we had a webinar on a town hall on personal risk. That was very interesting. So maybe Shorna, if you'd like to start giving us a brief synopsis of what's going on in the TRO setting. Is Shorna here? Well, let's switch to Courtney. Courtney, are you here?
I am.
Okay, yeah, so we just got off of a hour and a half academic integrity discussion that all relative to online instruction. Maybe talk a little bit about that, Courtney, what we're gonna be doing and any other thing that comes to mind in your setting.
Yeah, so just to start, I mean, I will try to be brief to leave room for questions, which is, you know, probably the best use of our time. But, you know, just a reminder of how CPOT is operating from my perspective. So, you know, I'm a faculty representative on CPOT, which has several subcommittees. There's a subcommittee on technology issues surrounding online delivery, a subcommittee on, you know, student engagement issues, a subcommittee on international students, a subcommittee allegedly on finance issues, though they remain mysterious to me. And finally, the subcommittee on substantive curriculum and online delivery issues, which is pretty much everything in the classroom, except for the technology side. So, you know, I'm on several of these subcommittees, but I'm also working with a group of faculty who are themselves working with further focus groups. So we're trying very hard to capture, you know, kind of a maximal tranche of faculty concerns and suggestions for further work. So yeah, academic integrity issues have obviously been at, I don't want to say the core, because I don't really think that we're in a state yet where the most important part of our work is catching cheaters in classes. You know, I think we've got more going on in our teaching than that, but academic integrity is a huge issue right now. There are numerous scandals being prosecuted in various colleges, a lot of them having to do with new resources that have become newly useful to students, like Chegg and Course Hero, which have long hosted It's been a lot of people, you know, people post their homework there and then get the answers to homeworks, but typically have not been able to use it for exams because exams have been in person and proctored. Now that exams are not in person or proctored, students are posting entire exams to Chegg, getting the answers there. And that's obviously an unsupportable situation. So at the town hall today, we heard from several of the Academic Integrity Hearing Board chairs and other other faculty who are involved directly or indirectly with these issues. We talked about, so Laura Brown is putting together a kind of guidebook of information for faculty on the kinds of violations that we've been seeing, and we'll blend that in with some suggestions that we developed in the town hall today for approaches to fight academic integrity violations. And I'd be glad to field some questions about that later on. Beyond the integrity issues, of course we've been thinking hard about the kinds of resources we can develop for faculty, both in terms of course design and assessment recommendations, including, of course, suggestions to fight academic integrity violations, addressing the specialized software or supply needs where possible, and mostly just trying to avoid reinventing the wheel for faculty who are already stressed about planning for the shift to online, which is likely to affect lots and lots of us. Beyond that, we've been thinking about strategies to mitigate the kind of sense of isolation that I think the sudden shift to remote delivery built up in many of our classrooms. So thinking about how we can rebuild our classrooms and our larger community relations, again, in the likely event that many of us are only in virtual contact in the fall, and talking about how to do this by supporting co-curricular resources, identity centers, residential life activities, et cetera, and even helping faculty integrate those services into their classrooms. So I will stop there, but I'm glad to answer or attempt to answer questions.
Any questions for Courtney? Okay, very good. So we have like 2.5 weeks before these reports are done, and the major decisions will probably follow 1 or 2 weeks thereafter. So this is very, very important work. We got to make sure the faculty keeps track of this so that we can contribute to the discussions. So thanks again, Courtney. Okay, Jill, let's go to the calendar discussion.
Shorna is on.
Oh, great. Shorna.
Sorry, I was jumping from one Zoom meeting to the next. I can give a quick update on the committee for teaching reactivation options. So all of you faculty received an email today about the procedures and policies that would be in place should the campus reopen for in-person, for some degree of in-person instruction in the fall. So I just direct your attention to that the policies and procedures that would be in place if there was a residential semester would be mask wearing, physical distancing, restricting non-essential travel, enhanced sanitation protocols, limiting in-person dining and food services, adhering to contact tracing and quarantine protocols, restricting access to campus facilities, de-densifying, all of those things. Obviously a really important concern throughout all of this that the committee has really been grappling with is the concept of personal risk and personal safety, and really not wanting to compromise anyone with regard to teaching obligations. And so that's something that was also critical to this, is that that really safeguarding our Cornell community, safeguarding our local community, protecting vulnerable faculty, staff, and students while also mitigating overall public health risks are really a priority. And so I think that communication was really meant to lay out some of those things that would be in place. And it also went over the kind of teaching modalities that it might be in-person instruction with remote access, completely online course, or perhaps a hybrid course and or modality of instruction. And when one of the things that the committee has also really been focusing on is really the considerations around our behavior, the behavior of our students, and the significant role that we would all play in protection of the community from infections. And we're engaging with behavioral scientists across Cornell to really look at what are effective communication strategies and around social norms and compliance and motivation, particularly with undesirable kinds of behaviors and things like that. And so we've talked about really how to engage students as part of the solution, because we have a number of student leaders that would really be really key partners in this, whether it's Greek Life, student organizations, et cetera. We really have to really engage students right now as part of the solution if this is really going to be effective. And so that's what we're doing, is working with those student leaders on campus and also those leaders in student and campus life. Also, one of the things that I wanted to mention also is just that the students themselves can come up with really creative out-of-the-box ideas as well. Human Ecology and both ILR are hosting kind of hackathons this at the end of this month and beginning of next month around some of these kinds of solutions and what we might think about. So that will also inform the committee deliberations as well, really hearing directly from students. And a survey of students is also being planned to go out very soon. So I just wanted to mention those as a few updates as well that the committee has been focusing on. And happy to take questions.
Questions for Shorna. Risa.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for these reports. They're really, really helpful. I wonder, Shorna, if you might discuss whether you had any discussions around privacy issues.
Yeah, so the privacy issues are something that are really critical. I just met this week with individuals at the library that were really responsible for the recent resolution on privacy concerns. So that information is being shared with the committee. Part of the recommendations that we talked about around privacy for the committee to consider in their recommendations is making sure that if there is any data that's being collected as part of a reopening process, whether it's around health data or tracing data, student behavior, anything like that, that data that we're collecting or that the university would be collecting, that we have a transparent process so that people know what data is being collected, how it's being used, to really have clear guidelines in place for the retirement of such data, that it not be archived, and that there be a committee set up to really examine and advise the university with regard to privacy concerns, because it's not necessarily something that the IT function of the university is necessarily looking at. And so having one of their suggestions was an advisory type committee or board that would really be able to provide direct kind of guidance on that, but that we really be quite cautious at the outset around data that we might be collecting on students and their behavior that would aid in contact, things like contact tracing, but it could also be utilized for unintended purposes. So thank you for bringing that up.
Just to follow up, this is also not just, of course, privacy of students, right? We're talking about also staff and faculty privacy issues. And I'm glad, yes, to hear that's, there may be a board, and obviously there are people on campus who study civil liberties issues, mm-hmm, including privacy. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It would actually be across the board, because I think any of these apps or tools that would be able to tell like who is in a particular location and when, you know, would be something that would be, you know, applied not just with students. So I agree.
Harold.
Yes. So some, if we're going to be having students return to campus, there's no reason why it has to be all students or no students. So depending on what course of study a given student is following, the case for allowing that student return to campus for in-person teaching can differ. So I'm wondering, the calendar, the possible options for the calendar did not try to distinguish between different groups of students, depending on what sort of courses they are taking. I mean, for some courses, I should think online teaching is virtually impossible. For other sorts of courses, I think it, although never as good as in-person teaching, I think it can work reasonably well. So I'm wondering whether people have thought about the possibility of being selective with regard to which students are going to be on campus. So for example, students in the vet school or in who are taking studio courses, I should think that the case for their being on campus is much stronger than for a student who's taking an entirely, say, humanities curriculum in which all classes could be done reasonably well online. So, so I'm wondering whether any thought has been given to working for an arrangement in which only some students would be on campus.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. And one of the, with the discussion of the calendaring options is that, you know, those courses that require a special facility like studio or lab courses, you know, those, you know, could potentially be prioritized for classroom or space assignments because they're not delivered, they're not easily delivered in an online environment. So that is one of the kind of criteria that would be utilized in kind of deciding, and also the class size. So there are some kind of factors that would be overlaid, I think, with any of these course options in terms of modality of online or in-person.
Levin,
can I say a little more?
There's some other people with their hands up we'd like to get to.
Okay.
Levin? Levin?
My question is closely related to Harold's. In terms of implementing this de-densification of campus, one of the biggest challenges will be to reduce the density on campus. I wonder if the committee considered giving the students the option to attend in person or remotely, because the provost email suggested that the faculty will have the option. Some faculty members will choose to teach remotely and others will teach in class, which is very nice. And faculty would consider the demands of their courses, their health situation, their age. But we could give the same option to students. Students could also make intelligent decisions. And if my guess is correct, we could have a 50-50 split, and that would reduce the density on campus. Then we could do all the other things like testing and isolation type of things much more easily. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good question, which is the sequencing, because right now it would be driven by faculty and their modality of the course. And then I think if students are not able to attend in person, if for example, that course were offered in person and they're, you know, living somewhere where they're still under travel restrictions, then they would not be able to, you know, potentially take that course. It would have to opt for ones that are online. But I think the decision-making would have to kind of flow from the curriculum down to the students. There haven't been discussions about sort of asking the students first and then, you know, shaping the curriculum that way, sort of from both angles. So that's an interesting question.
If I could follow up, yeah. We could ask the faculty first and then the students would know how the course is being taught.
Yes.
Of course, we can certainly have a hybrid model. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's teaching, and we do it all the time, with our faculty meetings, for example, and in-person, in-class teaching could also have a Zoom connection, and some students could join an in-class, in-person class remotely. So
that's
we
right.
Those hybrid type of solutions.
Yes, that's right, and that's what Courtney's committee has been looking at, because if there is, you know, a course that's meeting in person, but then someone is not able to attend, you know, that student would then be able to access that course remotely, ideally under ideal conditions. And I think also, you know, the important point is that, you know, students would have the choice to know how the course is being taught. Is the course being taught in person? Is it being taught totally online? Is it being taught in a hybrid manner, which I would imagine a lot of courses would have to be. Yeah, so I think the student choice is really important in all of this too, that they know what modality the courses are being offered in and what those options are. Ideally, yes.
Ken? Then we'll have to move on. Ken Berman.
I want to circle back to Reese's comments about privacy. I'm one of the people who's been looking into these contact tracing apps and other types of campus data collection. There's obviously no question that they intrude and potentially they gather quite a bit of private information. What's surprising is that many of these technologies might not actually work. In fact, you have to get quite a high penetration level, for example, with the contact tracing apps, for them to be at all useful. And at that point, there's still the human factors of contact tracing that enter in. So somebody saying, I was told by my phone that I was near somebody who was infected, may or may not actually contribute usefully to contact tracing. So I think Reese's point is very good. And those of us who have been looking at this have really been torn on the whole question. Now, on top of that, it isn't really clear that these apps work. And I'm saying that as a person who's really kind of an expert in this area. We need to test them ourselves, but it's very hard to get any concrete information about how well they work. You know, people say, oh, it's Bluetooth, that must have some magical properties. One of the magical properties is that if it's in somebody's purse, it may possibly be blocked. So I think Risa touched on something very, very important, that we not take steps to reassure people which aren't really effective, and they're sort of a false reassurance. And I'm not saying that necessarily tracing technologies are in that category, but we can't rule out that they might actually be in that category at this point. We're trying to learn more.
Yep. And also I would note that contact tracing is in the domain of Tompkins County Health Department. So they would actually be the agency responsible for doing any contact tracing of positive cases. So they would follow their procedures. So the health considerations subcommittee is looking at this in greater detail, but it would be, I think what they're examining would be potentially to augment, but you know, these, what you're saying about kind of the pros and cons of this, you know, there are some privacy concerns around consenting to use these. And so we really wanna make sure we're weighing the costs and benefits, or, you know, is the benefit great enough to justify, you know, this kind of intrusion into the privacy? And then is it also effective? It's not really effective. It's you know, probably not something we wanna be using. So I appreciate you raising all those points about the apps.
Okay, thanks an awful lot, Shorna, for an excellent overview of what's going on. Okay, let's get on to the calendar part here, Jill. So before we begin, let me just sort of say something. There are six calendar options out there. It's not a referendum. Each calendar has one or more interesting ideas, and that's what we should sort of focus on. As you know, from March, a calendar can change on a dime. You can suddenly have to go online if there's a hot spot here in Ithaca, or if there's a miracle vaccine discovered in the fall, the spring would look entirely different. All the calendars can be tweaked in small ways. And again, let's get on with it. So here's the current calendar. And what we'll call option zero is just that, only everything is online, okay? And
what are your calendars?
Literally, so it's simply a mapping of what we do now, only the students never come to campus and it's all online. Color coding, green is a class day, yellow is an exam day, brown or whatever is a study day, pink is a weekend or a break day. Next slide. So what you'll see in the remaining slides is sort of an axiom that when you go home at Thanksgiving, you don't come back until the new year, and often maybe not until the end of February or March. So this one, again, is the usual start time. The difference then is that when you go home, just before, well, that last week before Thanksgiving, you go home and you wrap up the course in those 3 weeks there, with 7 more class days followed by the usual exam study period. So that would be handled online. Then you stay home in the spring until middle of February, 4 weeks of online. And then there's a move-in period. And those red square, the squares with the red outline is the move-in process. And it will be staged. There's some thinking that's gone into this already, actually quite a lot of thinking, but what the students do during the move-in period and how you stage it is a very big issue. And you can sort of see then that in the end of February, students move back in anticipation of doing the rest of the semester in person. And again, you sort of see the usual exam period at the end. There's no senior week, so it's ending a week later, but that's what the spring would look like in option one. I should say the winter session, many of you probably don't know too much about it, but it will loom larger in importance because it's a way of picking up that extra course or getting a head start on something. So this particular calendar option preserves the winter session, which is 3 weeks. You typically do one course that moves at a rapid clip. Next option. The hallmark of this is a 4-week delayed start, motivated by the fact that we have to deliver a very high quality modified courses with some online content. So this would give you 4 extra weeks in the summer. You start up there sort of in the third week of September. There is an on-campus version of that. And then you go home, okay? And you wrap up the rest of the semester online, but it wraps around into January. So the 4 extra weeks in the summer bump everything into the new year, okay? So that's the main attribute of this particular calendar. This a word here about breaks. So yeah, there is a break there in the before Thanksgiving, but you're noticing here in these calendars, like there's no February break, there's no spring break. So these could be adjusted. So you don't want to make a break so long that it invites travel, but you do have the stress angle. So a possible tweak to some of these calendars is to put in a long weekend, and if you do that, then of course you have to either start a little bit earlier or later. So that is an issue, lack of breaks, but to pull off these options, you at least at the first pass, assume there are no regular breaks. Next slide. So this one isn't quite as delayed. It's only a 2-week delay. You start up just after Labor Day. And then the idea here that obviously needs to be fleshed out is that you have some form of on-campus assessment. So those yellow lines there, you can sort of think of them as a final exam-like week, right? Details, of course, to be worked out. But one of the big concerns that was brought up by Courtney is academic integrity and the interest in having in-person assessments. So with this particular option, there's enough wiggle room there to perhaps pull off something there just before Thanksgiving. You then go home for Thanksgiving and come back, and then you wrap up with 3 weeks of online and so on. There's no wraparound. You end in December. You still have a winter session. And then the spring starts up with 4 weeks of online, then a move-in process, and then a in-person wrap-up. Next slide. So here, this slide, option 4 and 5 have the property that the fall semester is split into modules. And then this one, it's a pair of roughly 7-week modules. So you'll notice that the first one is entirely on campus, and you'd have some kind of exam period. And again, details have to be worked out. How many study days? What does the exam period look like? And so on. But in any case, the idea here is splitting this fall into 2 modules, with the first one being entirely in person. And then the last one would be a mix. You start out with a few weeks of in person and then go online. Again, when you go home for Thanksgiving, you don't come back until sometime in February. You've already seen that spring calendar in option 3, so no need to talk right now about more details. But in any case, the idea here is to split that fall semester into these 2 modules. Last option, 5. Again, you split the fall, but not symmetrically. You have an 11-week, roughly, on-campus version with in-person testing, and then you sort of have a 3.5-week or a 4-week small online version where you would typically do, say, one course. So again, the advantage here is you have sort of a reduced, you know, maybe take 3 or 4 courses instead of 4 or 5 during the on-campus phase, and then do that single course online. Again, this supports a winter session, and it's the same spring calendar you see there as well. Okay, that's the quick overview, but let's look at this table that maybe will help frame our discussions. So every calendar has a fall and a spring. Every calendar has a certain number of weeks that are online and offline. Other attributes are when do you start, when do you finish. You also have these important attributes. So for example, options 3, 4, and 5 have a measure of on-campus final assessment in the fall. Okay, that's an important attribute for many people. All but the second option support a winter session. I didn't write it down there, but options 3 and 4 involve these compressed modules. So as you know, that would require substantial work for you to reshape your course into that reduced time. So these are all the options. Again, it's not a referendum. Each one has a certain feature that's worth discussing and thinking about. So there you go. And now, online, as I mentioned at the start, we already have like 600 comments from students and parents on this. But if you go to that webpage, which the link there at the top of the table, there's a little fork in the road, and faculty can go off and post their comments on a separate page so that we can see how each other thinks. That's it. So the idea here is to have just a general discussion, and happy to answer questions. I want to mention that I'm just the reporter here. Lisa Nietzsche, Kim Whedon, and David Schmoys especially have spent a lot of time on this with really helped shape this discussion, and I want to acknowledge that very much. So I should say this, I haven't read all 600 comments, but I read a lot of them. What's missing here, what students are calling option six, is what you may have read about at Notre Dame. In other words, start 3 or 4 weeks early and totally wrap up everything on campus before Thanksgiving. So I would say lots and lots of students have weighed in on that one. So that's kind of a missing option here. We did not consider this because of the, for various reasons, just to get the campus ready that quickly for early August start, this didn't seem possible. Then you'd have all the course prep work as well. I think one of the lessons we learned in S20 is that really valuable to have 3 weeks to prepare instead of two, which we could have done. And that extra week is really important in terms of designing your course in a positive way. Okay, so I see Joni has a hand up. Let's start.
Hi, thanks. So, my question, thinking aloud, first of all, I think, generally I lean toward option zero. That's the only one that seems, reasonable, I guess, ethically, not inviting people into a situation in which they might, lose their lives. Otherwise, I'm thinking option four, with the 2 week modules, and the ways that when we discuss ways of de-densifying, thinking of smaller groups to invite to campus, ways of having a somehow minimized student and course population. If somehow for designing or offering these seven week course is a way to begin thinking about de-densifying the campus and then moving to online. So that's my thought.
That's right. Yeah. So it gives you wiggle room there by having the two 7 week modules. If a student takes two courses instead of four, that you sort of having traffic on campus. There are all different ways of looking at that, and so on. Levent and then Mark Lewis. Levent. Okay. Yes. Mark Lewis.
Hi.
Hold on. Levent and then Mark. Levent. Yeah.
Yeah. All of these options are on or off. Either all the students are on campus or all the students are off campus. It doesn't consider, similar to my previous comment, hybrid solutions. For example, option zero, I'm also leaning towards option zero like Joni, but option zero says everything is online. Everything doesn't have to be online. We could have a hybrid option. Some students make on campus, some voluntarily. Some students may wanna take courses off campus that will de-densify the campus. And under that hybrid model, we can easily implement option zero. And all of these options have hybrid versions. I mean, it doesn't have to be on or off. It doesn't have to be all students are here or all students are gone.
That's right. Well, the calendars displayed clearly show you where the class days are. If we're on campus, you might have your big CS1 course taken remotely, right? And so on. So don't confuse on campus and off campus with online or not. And we can have versions of your schedule as an undergraduate might have a mix of classes where you take in person and remotely online. In terms of inviting subsets, that's been studied, but it's extremely complicated. For example, let's not have the freshmen come this year, and then we can have the population in the dorms. But then what happens next year? Okay. You can look at some of the colleges. Some colleges are more self-contained than others. You mentioned law and the vet school. Those are professional schools. But for example, AAP, you might be think about that group as being somewhat able to come back on its own. All these things raise equity issues. you know, you can shut down the dorms, but then who can afford living in College Town? Well, the rich students and so on. So it's extremely complicated, but I can safely say from my vantage point, every possibility is being considered, every single one. So in terms of, again, invite having subsets of students here, maybe a certain subset in the fall, in the spring, or freshmen in the first 7 weeks, sophomores in the second. You can look at all these things, and sometimes they sound good at first glance or look good at first glance, but then you start thinking about how would you implement this and is it fair? You get into big complications. But good points, Liz. Mark Lewis.
Well, I mean, my solution is a little different. My solution is completely voluntary, to leave it to students, whether they want to come on campus or stay off campus and attend classes remotely. And I don't know if that's being considered. I mean, students, I mean, you know, they can make decisions. They can look at courses. They can look at the demands on their time, on their health, on their family, their financial resources. And I'm not sure if that is being considered at all. Everybody's talking about bringing certain groups that we decide that they should be here.
But it is, I mean, this, the taking into consideration international students, you know, some courses, so those things are being considered and whatever. But again, we can't answer everything. I can't answer everything right now, but please post your ideas. I can guarantee you, we will look at them. Mark Lewis.
Thank you. So I did a little conversation with my faculty before coming here, about 20 of us, and the overwhelming, I guess I can say, sentiment was that we should try to maintain the same timing as we would have otherwise. So basically what I'm trying to say is that we're avoiding coming back to campus in November, but we've basically are leaning toward option three for that reason, is that it is a continuous sort of set of time that mimics what we have now. So that's one quick thing. And then the other quick thing I want to mention to you and others is that some of our colleagues were saying that you could start classes early, but online for a few weeks, then have students move here to be on campus. So I don't think the two sets of people that would be helping to move them in are those people that would be actually moving. So then you get started a little early and avoid having anything after November as well. Thank you.
Good point. Let's see, Ravi, and then Carl, then David. Ravi.
Hi. I just had a comment, I guess, about if we teach classes in person, whether they be lectures, discussion sections, what have you, at some point, maybe students will be ill, maybe they'll need to be quarantined, and we'll essentially have to do an online version of that as well. And I just want to make sure that people are thinking about that when in this planning, because it, you know, it's here this semester we did everything online after whatever it was in March, but to sort of do a hybrid version where you're doing it both online and in class strikes me as a lot of extra work, or at least, you know, maybe CTI will help us and make that work out. Thanks.
That is correct. Behind every one of these things, from the faculty point of view, is how much work and will it be possible for me to reshape my course and to accommodate these things. And students, of course, look at you know, the opportunities, the stress angle, and things like that. I think one thing that Mark sort of brought up is if two courses don't overlap in the current schedule, you don't want them overlapping in the new schedule. We have to pay a lot of attention to graduation dates, courses that have that are fall spring sequences. We have to be very careful about that. And there's kind of a truth in advertising thing, which is to say we have to really portray the course time roster with these details, online, offline, remote, with these details before students commit to coming back. It would be very unethical to portray a certain thing and then they get here and things are totally different. Let's go on to Carl.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I sure appreciate the tough work that people are doing in these preparations, and also the efforts that must be going on behind the curtain to keep Cornell afloat financially. I really appreciated the extra time we had to prepare for our spring. I taught a lab course and it was really beneficial. But I would argue from that we could follow the Notre Dame model. And I think we should really have that on the table because I think we can do that. The hardest thing I could say is that we had to change our plans a couple of times because, and it's totally fair that the administration had to respond to the changing circumstances. But I really appreciate how Cornell is preparing in a good way for this. But my question is the following. While we prepare for it, our freshman customers vote with their feet. And so I'm very curious as to know how are we doing at filling the freshman class? I mean, that also bears, I guess, on our finances. Families elected to defer? Are they allowed to defer? Our students? What is the situation for a freshman looking at Cornell who is he committed? And are people turning away from Cornell?
I'll say three things. So if you look at this time last year, you know, there are different levels of commitment, you know, the April 30th deadline, yeah, I'm coming. So that statistic is actually a little bit higher than normal, okay? However, then pending now is a survey that the administration is gonna send out to all undergraduates, sort of saying, what's going through your head? I don't know the questionnaire, but they're gonna try to get at this issue about, we can deliver this, is this enough for you to come back? I'm just sort of paraphrasing. So there's gonna be a systematic gathering of data like that. But I can bet that when August comes around, the students can have the gap year and defer. And right now, each college runs that show, and there's certain rules about it. And I think those rules have to be revisited before we get to August. But it's gonna be pretty hard to say no to a student who says in August, you know, I studied your campus safety, I studied all these things, and you know, I just wanna take a gap year. It's gonna be very hard to say no to that. So I would anticipate a big scene in August, one way or the other. David Delchamps.
Charlie, can I just jump in for a moment based on something that's going on in the chat? So a lot of you have raised the question of an early start. And one of the issues that goes into considering the early start in the fall is that several of our colleagues already have commitments over the summer in terms of their research, in terms of the work they've already said they're going to be doing. And this also plays into the argument of, you know, when we can start. They don't have the time to commit to preparing for their courses in quite the same way. So that's an important piece to remember as well.
Thank you, Nima. That's absolutely true. You know, just a quick thing before we go to David. Schools that are on the quarter system, they sort of have the advantage. They can play with their summers a little more than those of us on the semester system. So if you look out there, you see universities taking advantage of that. David Delchamps.
Okay, I didn't have the data point that Nima just threw on the table. I was going to speak for part of this in favor of thinking about the Notre Dame model, at least putting it on the table, because not only are the students and parents on board with that, a lot of faculty members in their comments have said how much they favor that, because that involves, it leaves open on-campus assessment, et cetera, you know, none of this half online, whatever. Now, as far as what Robbie was talking about, in terms of do we have to do things for, you know, we'll have to do things for people who are sick, et cetera. Of course, there's gonna be international students who can't get back to the country who still want to enroll in our courses. They're gonna need to have a way to take the courses. I've assumed all along that in the fall, when we do in person, we will also have to record our lectures. And I've also assumed that we are not going to be able to shoot for synchronous online delivery for the same reasons we weren't able to shoot for synchronous online delivery this spring, because there are people in mainland China, et cetera, who can't access our courses synchronously. Conclusion I've drawn is that what remote access to our courses is going to mean, and this is going to be necessary not only for international students, but also for those who get sick during the semester, is going to be limited to lectures are recorded and you could Zoom with the professor. I think that's what it's going to be. We're not going to need a room for every class to be able to have a synchronous Zoom access, a TA sitting in the back fielding questions for people online. It's just going to be recording lectures and Zooming with the professor. That's my piece on that.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. I forgot to bring up, if you look at any of our classrooms, there's a certain square footage, and you divide that by 50 if you want to do the 6-foot spacing, and then you can get an estimate about how many people you can fit in there. In general, it's usually around 20 to 30% of what you normally would put in there. So you can see there's a gigantic room availability scene here. So the kind of mixed thing that David is talking about is one way of addressing that. More questions? I'm not looking at the chat. Jill, can you read some stuff on the chat that we should talk about?
There's a concern about when the local schools will be starting and if that will affect, you know, people's ability to start their teaching and when, and lack of summer camps this year, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, trying to do our work is creating huge angst. Nima, we were talking about that yesterday, and you were really articulate about what faculty are facing who have all these things piled on top of them. Nima, you there?
But I've been in so many meetings, I don't remember what I was talking about.
You're so eloquent. Come on. So it was just like, just so talk about, suppose I have to prepare my course during the summer. There are no summer camps. Describe the scene.
It came up in the chat as well. It's coming up with a lot of people. There are no summer camps, and we don't know when schools are going to reopen. And so for those of us who have children in the schools or young children who go to daycare, this is a huge issue. There are, and so this is something that we are trying to make sure is part of the conversation when we think about using the summer to prepare for classes in the fall, whichever format it's going to be in. So this issue, actually, I think it's Ken Berman, I'm reading from the chat, brings this up in a different kind of way when he says, unclear to me which options force me to create a whole new set of lectures and which ones basically are compatible with being able to work mostly from my existing set of lectures from previous semesters. So, each one of these options, as we're evaluating them, we all need to consider how much is going to take to completely restructure a course. Are you just taking your course on, into a virtual space, or are you, and how are we really beginning to think about how we actually create a really valuable, excellent learning experience online, and how much work is going to take us to do that? In the committees, the online committee that I'm a part of, that Courtney and I are a part of, the discussion is around creating an excellent virtual experience. So it's going to take some amount of work from us. It's not going to be the same as the spring, where what we were mostly trying to do, we were working super hard. It was a heroic effort, but we were taking existing courses and taking them online. We're really going to have to start thinking about the fall, not just as taking an existing experience, but to transform it, to make it truly excellent. So it's going to take some work. So in response to Ken's comment, I don't think you can just stick with your 27 lectures. We're going to have to think of how the assignments change. We're going to have to think of how we build the community in the classroom that differently. And most importantly, what Courtney raised earlier, and that Charlie also raised, questions of academic integrity. We're seeing, a huge jump in some people think it's a huge jump, some people think it's not so huge, but we're discovering it more easily now. But we're seeing a jump in terms of integrity violations. So as you review these options, as we discuss these back with our departments, I think the question really should also be not just about the start, but how much work it's going to be taking us, going back to Ken's comment. So I don't know, Charlie, that's, I think, in terms of everything that we've been hearing in the last couple of days in and out of meetings, these are the kinds of issues that come up a lot.
That's right, yeah. So again, when you start looking at these things hard, they're always the trade-off. So for example, if we did the Notre Dame thing and you rigidly just move that entire regular fall semester back 3 weeks, you'd have minimal changes to your course, theoretically, and you'd have a longer research period, you know, from Thanksgiving into whatever it is in spring. So, but then all the reasons that were just discussed here, why it would be an extremely tough challenge. But so we really encourage you to look hard at these things, if only to discover the complexity of it. Again, as I said, sometimes it looks great when you glance at it, but then you start thinking, gee, what does this really mean? Risa has her hand up.
Yeah, thanks. On the point that we were just discussing about the issue of labor, of course, it's not just our labor. It's also staff labor. It's also, teaching assistants, labor, graduate assistants, et cetera. And so I think this is also one of those moments to remind ourselves of how important it is for people's jobs to be preserved. I mean, we actually have more work to do, not less. And so I wonder if anybody has any updates on those issues of preserving jobs and the administration. Have they given any updates on that?
The big watershed event is going to be early July. You know, these reports or recommendations go to the president and provost June 15th. Then that's the watershed event is how we're going to handle the fall. And at that point, all these things, there's a huge fork in the road there about the issues you just sort of mentioned, right? So Nima, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
No, I mean, I agree with you, Charlie. I think, Risa, how many jobs we're able to maintain will really depend in part on how many students we can bring back, right? So faculty jobs are secure, but the staff questions are so dependent on student campus life, on all the other kind of co-curricular things that we run. And so there's a lot of issues here that will start to come up once we land on a decision of who's coming back, how many can come back, and what we can teach.
David Delchamps.
Very quickly, I just wanted to throw in, I think we should go with an option that does not commit us to a big change for the spring. I think we can wait to see what's going on, see what's happening, see how this thing flows to decide on what happens with the spring. That's my personal opinion on that. So the Notre Dame model or option one, I think, for example, are the two that have the least impact on the spring, least commitment. Okay.
And when those 600 postings, that also, people are saying, why are you thinking about the spring? Well, one of the options has wraparound into January and you sort of start having to think about that. So I can sort of think of those spring calendar proposals, they're just sort of placeholders. And we need a lot more information about how the pandemic plays out before those details are wrapped up and so on.
Can I mention one other thing, Charlie, around the start date too, which is wrapped up in this, which is our capability to do rapid testing and to really ramp that up for every single member of the Cornell population, faculty, staff, and student. And so I think some of the delayed start is also around when the Cornell Vet Diagnostic Lab could be up and running for the capability of these tests, as well as when the experiments and the data would be there for the accuracy of saliva tests, which would be much more comfortable to do than the nasal swabs on a week or 2 week basis, whatever interval that surveillance testing would take place. So I know that's another variable that plays into the start date as well.
Do people feel we should actually flesh out, and it would only take like half an hour, and option six, which is the early start, just so we collect comments on it? Or do we feel, I haven't been looking at the chat line, is it sort of really off the table? Well, we don't have to answer it right now, but we'll take a look at that.
Well, and from a student perspective, it seems there's a appetite for that option from a student perspective, so that they, the thing that students have been talking about is the challenge of doing online work from home after Thanksgiving, and that they would prefer to end the semester at Thanksgiving if there's an option to do that.
Okay. Well, we're at time. And again, thank you for the discussion. And please share your thoughts. It's great to see how the other person thinks on all this sort of stuff. And it's going to be part of the the recommendation of the TRO committee is certainly going to be there'll be certainly calendar chit chat in the final report, and all your comments are extremely important to make sure we portray all the positives and negatives. Okay, with that, I guess we're all done, and I'd like to thank you again and all the speakers and so on. Okay, bye-bye, everybody.